Hello and welcome once again to Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. You are with me, Jason McKenna, talking to your local politicians. So as we speak today, Bim, it is so-called Freedom Day. It is upon us. Are you happy with this and do you feel free?
I do feel free. I think it's worth saying I did not feel free before. Look, my view has always been, and I'm sure I've told you this on the radio, that we need, as soon as possible, to move back to a situation where we have our normal lives back. And though the public health crisis is still there, we've moved beyond the acute phase of that crisis because of the vaccine rollout. And I think this is the right thing to do. For people who say, no, we need to, you know, they may have issues with, say, with the mask, not making masks compulsory and smaller things like that. I think that's a reasonable argument to have. But for those, and it's a small number, who seem to think that we should have sort of restrictions ad infinitum until COVID goes, well, I'm afraid COVID isn't going to go. You will not find a public health expert in the world who thinks COVID is going to disappear. So really, you know, if not now to release restrictions, once you've vaccinated all vulnerable people, when? So I think now is the right time, particularly in the summer, particularly when schools aren't around. This is the time to do it. And, you know, by all means, people should be cautious. But, you know, it's the right time to do it.
One of the concerns, though, Bim, is the growing number of cases. And this has led to hospitalizations, but not the huge spike that we saw a little bit earlier in deaths. Is there a chance that there could be a third lockdown?
Well, frankly, I hope not, because if there were, I think there would be a significant social, political, economic difficulty. So I think that would be a huge, huge tragedy. I don't think it's going to happen. Why do I not think it's going to happen? Because once you've vaccinated people who are likely to die, then you have really done the core function that you need to do as a society and as a state. There is an issue with a small number of unvaccinated people who are vulnerable. Those older groups who, for whatever reason, chose not to take the vaccine. On some level, you know, I don't think you can impose lockdowns or very heavy public health restrictions for a small number of people who refuse to take vaccines, I'm afraid. And more broadly, the really important thing for people to know is that our excess death rates, so the rate of deaths that is beyond what you would expect for this time in the year, is below average at the moment. Not only is it below average, the number of COVID deaths is incredibly low, despite a very high number of cases. What does that mean? It means that the vaccines have broken the link to a very large degree between cases and hospitalizations and deaths. And that is a really key thing.
Could the problem be, though, that with the hospitalizations increasing, that the NHS is once again overcome? Some people have said that because the Delta variant was noticed on the 1st of April, but it took 22 days for that Indian variant and the country of India to be placed on the red list, that it was a failure of the government. Do you believe that this is a problem?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid that that doesn't even bear even the smallest amount of scrutiny. And the reason for that is that the Delta variant is now the dominant variant across most countries in the world where this is being tracked. So unless you want to blame every single government in the world, now it's possible that every single government could have made exactly the same mistake at exactly a similar point, or accept that viruses mutate. That's what viruses always do. And whether you open the borders with India are closed, partially closed for on this day or that day, frankly, makes no difference in the overall path of this. And I think it's very important for people to appreciate and understand.
Keeping an eye on the future then, Bim, you are quite the environmentalist. There was a build, and there is actually through August, a Build a Bee hotel event in Harpenden. Will you be constructing one?
I will try and go if I'm around. Now look, what I'm about to say, bees are very important. I know bees are very important. I've been told for many years that you should never kill bees because they're very, very important to our ecosystem. However, when you've got small children running around, I think having too many bees at home is probably not the wisest thing. So I think I'll give that one a miss.
I mean, the problem with the bees is that the children might kill them instead. But in a recent interview, again, kind of highlighting your love for the environment, you said that you love your garden in an old manish way. Have you been making any use of growing foods or anywheres in your garden through this summer?
I haven't been because I'm very useless at growing things. But my wife does grow lots of things, and she's got various vegetable patches with tomatoes and various flowers and carrots and all sorts of other stuff. And I think we've eaten some of them, actually. But, well, I do, because I eat my greens. Of course I do. So, of course, I've eaten them. But I myself, I'm not very good at that. I tend to use the garden for mowing and just taking the perverse, slightly bizarre male interest in wanting to mow on a frequent basis and making sure the garden looks nice, and not entirely sure why, but it just makes me feel happy. And also to play football or cricket with my boys. Though when you do start doing this, and people listening to this with young children will appreciate, is that the danger of starting to play any sport with them is that they never want to stop playing, and they've got considerably more energy than you do. So this can end up taking a very long time.
I thought you'd whip out some of your early university football skills, though, that you've actually kind of discussed with us in the past. I mean, have you taught the little ones to be able to have the skills that you have?
No, they're doing all right, actually. They're doing all right. They're quite good, especially my older son, Zach. He's good at football, actually. So, but no, I... it's very sad. I can't believe you reminded me of that. It's very, very sad to be very proud of sort of like schoolboy or university sports. It makes you seem like, you know, you're like, it's like the sort of person who tells you they were sort of captain of hockey at the age of 12. You know, it's deeply sad and uncool to talk about these things. So thank you for reminding everybody that I am bizarrely proud of my ability to play football when I was much younger. So thank you for that.
Well, I thought it'd be just good to highlight people. You know, there might be an Arsenal scout out there for, you know, 30s and up. But let's move the attention then to the local area. And one of the things that has been grabbing your attention has been working on better internet access. The lockdown has highlighted the essential need for its rollout. What is being done for broadband coverage in the local area?
So basically, the Minister responsible for broadband, who also used to live in this constituency, might I add, called Matt Warman. He came and did a visit with BT Openreach. And so as a result of that visit, it's great news that I think it's about 11,000 households and businesses will benefit from high-speed full fiber broadband as part of a sort of government rollout of gigabit broadband, which, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure what a gigabit is, but it's very fast, I am told. So it's very, very good and very fast. And now the thing now is to make it much easier for rural properties and people in flats to benefit from this rollout. So I think that that's my next job now. And the government's updating something called the Electronic Communications Code to sort of future-proof it for communities across the country. So yes, we made a start. I think that it's comparatively easy to do sort of in a town or a city houses. What we now need to do is make sure rural properties and people in flats get them. So that's my next thing.
Moving it to more government-based things. And last month when I spoke to you, you explained that IDing of voters was to prevent future problems from occurring with voting. So yeah. Why is there now a disempowering or even removal of the Electoral Commission? This is obviously a body that independently regulates party and election finances and sets standards of how elections should be. Surely this puts at risk the integrity of all British democracy. Or is there another explanation really? For this,
Bim? I mean, it doesn't, I'm afraid. And the reason why it doesn't is, as a Member of Parliament, having not had direct dealings with the Electoral Commission, thank goodness, but knowing what they do, it is, you know, it can do with a lot of improvement, I think it's fair to say. And the new chair of the Electoral Commission, I was on Radio 4 on Sunday night on Week in Westminster, and the chair did an interview, and even he said he thought the Electoral Commission could improve in lots of ways, right? So it can improve. the ability to remove the thing to remove their ability to prosecute is important, because you don't want to, you want the Electoral Commission to, like any other body, to be able to refer cases to police. The difficulty with the Electoral Commission being able to prosecute itself was what they did to certain people in the aftermath of the referendum and other elections, where they sort of disproportionately went after, frankly, very small fish, people without resources, people who were just ordinary people. And that just was hugely disproportionate, and they sort of abused the power that they had. And so I think it's important that we put them on a basis where, by all means, if there's been something inappropriate, they should refer it to the police, in the same way that any of us or any organisation, any public body can refer things to the police. But I think that that's a sensible way forward.
So is it just going to be reform rather than a total throwing out of the Electoral Commission?
Yes, the Electoral Commission still exists. We'll still, you know, its resources are still there. They're not cut. Still has, you know, it's not like reducing the number of people who work for it. In fact, I think the number of people who work for it will go up. But I think it's just putting it on a more sensible basis.
Also this month, the government released the data on how young white working class children are being left behind. Some of the focus on this, why it happened, is being pinned on linguistics and what's being taught in schools. But even if this is true, with the Conservatives being in power since 2010, this must be considered a problem that you've yet to fix with 10 years of power. Who else is to blame?
So this is inherently the difficulty of when you've been in government a while, which is anything you say you want to try and improve, almost by definition, you could have done something about before, right? So on some level, you can make a reasonable argument and say over the last 10 years, it hasn't been enough of a focus for us to work on this particular group. I think that that's a reasonable argument. But that, I would prefer us to now say, no, we need to change and improve our focus, than to just not do anything, lest we were accused of not doing enough 10 years before. So my view is, I'll take the political hit of, oh, you should have done more 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. I'll take that. And now say what we need to do is get it right for the future.
So with that in mind, then, why has there been a decrease in real spending since 2015?
There has been, but that's now being reversed. So, and I forget the exact numbers, but by the end of this parliament, 2024, we would have reversed that and actually got a real terms increase since that time. Since I first came into parliament, I've made the case that we need to improve per child school spending, but not just improve the spending just for the sake of it. It's to make sure that that is spent more fairly. So if you look at the allocation of funding, now I don't want to make this too technical, but it's very important. Funding for schools is not given per head or per child identically spread across the country. There are various formulae that go into how much each child gets. And to put it frankly, kids in big cities get a lot more per head than in our own constituency. Now, there are various good reasons for that. Some of it's to do with the increased cost of providing things in cities, some of which is, you know, whether it be labor costs, so the cost of teachers and staff. Others are deprivation indices. So for example, if kids can't speak English, they may need more intensive work. But also, frankly, in our area, it's incredibly expensive to employ people. It's incredibly expensive to maintain buildings. We also have a lot of old buildings. We also have a lot of rural schools. We needed a fairer funding formula, and that's what we've put in. So it's not, people shouldn't really think about per child what the number is. What you should think about, in not just in this constituency, but across the country, is how that is distributed across the country, because almost no child gets the per child number, if that makes sense. So in this constituency, we are going to see quite larger than your average increase because of our changes we're making to the national funding formula, which I think are very important.
Another area that a lot of people have sent in messages about and a lot of discussions are around the new Nationality and Borders Bill. Royal National Lifeboat Institution has voiced its worries that people being saved from a sinking ship and preventing the loss of life could cause them to be imprisoned for aiding immigration. The Home Office has insisted that the bill is targeted at ruthless criminal gangs. However, George Pertes has said that the RNLI-type rescue operations involving asylum seekers seem to fit the bill of definition of facilitating. And when I discussed this matter with Bambos Charalambos this month, he also voiced similar concerns. Could you explain how this situation of saving lives will not be criminalised?
I don't know enough about the RNLI particularly, so I don't want to comment on that because I don't want to get myself in trouble. What I do know is that it is important that we go after criminal gangs that traffic people to this country and get paid for it. I don't make any apologies for that. In the definition of that, we have to make sure that we make sure that we are getting after the right people. And that's why there's a whole parliamentary process. This bill is going to take months to go through parliament. You know, that's why we have this debate, we have the process, and hopefully we'll iron out these difficulties. It's worth saying that Bambos Charalambos, despite being a very nice man and having a fantastic name, is a Labour MP, and they're opposing the bill. I'm not saying that makes his judgment wrong. I'm just making the point that, you know, for politically Labour opposing it. So of course he's going to say bad things about it. And George Perret's QC, if it's the guy who I occasionally follow on Twitter, is pretty anti-government as well. Now, again, that's not to say that what he says is inherently wrong. I'm just making the point that one shouldn't take necessarily what political opponents of the government say as necessarily being true. It's my view that we have a sensible, robust system of immigration in this country. There are many legal ways to come to this country, like my own parents did and my own father did in the 1980s. I think it's important that people go by the legal routes and not try and claim asylum where they're not entitled to. And what we are doing with this is we're retaining the right to claim asylum, but we are going after the people that will exploit vulnerable people in many countries of the world by getting them to pay for often very unsafe passage to this country to claim asylum when they're not entitled to. And I think that that's what we need to crack down on them. And we're giving the border force more resources, more ability to deal with this problem, because they are in many senses prevented from doing so by the existing law.
Do you worry though that the focus on criminalisation and these sorts of discussions are overlooking the plight of a lot of genuine refugees who want to make it to this country?
No, I think that, so the important thing for people to appreciate is that the law on asylum is very, very specific and it's global. It's not a British law on asylum or a French law on asylum, it's global. It's if you are fleeing persecution, and that's defined in lots of different ways, whether it be persecution because of your ethnic group or your family situation or your sexual orientation or whatever. If you're fleeing persecution, you can claim asylum in a safe country. Now, what we find in the UK is that a lot of people come through other safe countries, for example, in mainland Europe, places as deeply unsafe as France or Holland or Belgium or Germany or Spain, and they come through those countries and then come to the UK and try and claim asylum. Now, any fair-minded person will look at this and realize, hold on, if you were trying to just get to a safe country because you're fleeing persecution, you've come through 2, 3, 4, 5 safe countries before you got here. Therefore, you've got to consider, why is that person doing that? The reason why that person will often be doing that, not always, but often, is because they are coming to the UK for economic reasons. And by the way, there is nothing wrong with coming to the UK for economic reasons, but they should do that under the proper process. They should say, I want to come to the UK to come under economic reasons. And then there are a series of rules, a bunch of tests that you have to go through for economic reasons. You may be a member of the healthcare. You want to come and work in the NHS. You may come and want to be an entrepreneur. You may come and want to set up a business, whatever it is you may want to come and do. That is perfectly great. And we welcome those people, but they've got to come through the proper process. That's the point.
Since we last spoke to you, Bim, you've launched a new monthly survey for constituents. Why have you done this? And has the feedback been useful so far?
It's been really useful because the difficulty when you're a member of parliament is you do live in a world of politics and you think that people are interested in the things that you are interested in. And they sometimes are, but they sometimes aren't. And so why I'm doing this monthly survey online is for that reason. So it's been really useful. I've picked up a lot of information from it. In particular, a lot of the work I do on road safety. So, you know, Redbourne Road that we've talked about. There's also been a fatal accident on St Albans Road, something I brought up with the Prime Minister, Prime Minister's questions, was it last week or the week before? So those sorts of things I knew about, but there've been other things that have come through on road safety that I didn't know about through this survey. There are lots of other examples. So look, I think it's really useful.
What I would also like to ask is something that I am researching. Have people used this as an opportunity and maybe exploited it to send you abusive messages?
Weirdly, no, they haven't. I don't know what's going on. I don't know. The abusers will now come out in force, I'm sure.
Oh, dear.
But no, they haven't. Actually, people have been incredibly sort of careful and really serious about it. And we've got something like sort of over 800 piece of individual feedback so far, which is quite a lot in a couple of months. So, and they've been quite different about quite different things. So no, people have not been abusive, I don't think.
I'm glad to hear that there hasn't been.
But now the abusers will now come.
I'm glad so far, no unsavoury, and I hope after this discussion that nobody gets the wrong idea, because you know, all the abuse is deplorable.
Thanks for asking that. Now all the abusers will think they're not sending me enough abuse.
Well, I'm going to switch it up to maybe a nice final question from me before we go into the community questions. In one of the discussions that I have done with Bambos Charalambos over the last few weeks, he recently put up a viral picture of him as a, you know, good-looking 18-year-old, stylish. And I asked him if he was proud of the journey.
Really?
It was quite interesting to talk about his route into politics from the age of 18. So I wanted to ask you as well, Bim, would you say that your 18-year-old self would be proud of where you are now? And how politically active were you at that age?
I was politically interested, but not politically active. Would they be proud of where I am now? Proud has a certain sort of ethical sense. I'm not sure I would be proud or not proud. I mean, I just try and do a good job. I think I would probably be quite proud that I'd made it into Parliament, because I think I'd wanted to have done that by the time I was 35 and I was elected at 31. So I think my 18-year-old self would have been quite proud of that. I think my 18-year-old self would have probably still been in the mode of tracking Napoleon and wondering why I hadn't been first consul by now. Thankfully, I think tracking Napoleon is something that should be left with 18-year-old boys and should be left there very firmly. So yes, I think I was politically interested, and I'd just be very glad, I think, to have made it in Parliament, because I knew that was where you could really do the most good in terms of public sort of public policy and public life. So, yeah.
And one of the other discussions we had recently is you said certain family members had more left-wing leanings than yourself. Would 18-year-old self...
I haven't sufficiently brainwashed them.
Would you say that your 18-year-old self would have been to more of the left or to the right, or do you not find those kind of labels actually useful?
My 18-year-old self was probably to the left of where I am now, because I think I didn't have nearly as much of a sense of how successful enduring positive change occurs. You know, the problem with being 18 is that revolutions and to some degree extremism is always quite exciting and fresh, new and different. And again, inherently, one can make that argument that it's not a bad thing at all. But I think my 35-year-old self, or indeed my 31-year-old self when I was elected first, I think recognizes that enduring change happens in a more sustained, ingrained, gradual sort of way. And I don't think I'd have appreciated that at 18.
So let's move it to the community questions. The first one is from Catherine. She said, would you please ask BIM his opinion on the proposed renovation of Watford General Hospital versus a purpose-built hospital on a new site? She's given quite a lot of information that I have sent over to you.
Okay, I haven't seen it. But I mean, look, I know about this issue and, you know, my father's a doctor in that trust, so I know about it. Nobody would put a hospital, if you were starting from scratch, nobody would put a hospital next to a football club. It is not the best place for a major hospital. I think that's just plainly obvious. The question is how best now to move forward. And my understanding is that the government quite a while ago now committed to, I think it's about £400 million to a new, you know, to upgrading Watford General significantly. That I think is money that we need to take and we need to do the best with. By all means, if there's a proposal for a new hospital that can do it for the same amount and they think they can buy the land and do a new hospital, then I think that should be looked at. But I'm yet to see something like that. What I have seen are things that are considerably more expensive. So I think that really is the difficulty.
You mentioned this a little bit earlier, Bim. Michael has raised it again about your campaigning for road safety in the area. What progress has been made, Bim?
Well, I think St Albans Road and Redbourne Road, we talked about. I mean, there's something on London Road, which is where there's a concrete batching plant, and that has been an issue. We're still trying to look at alternatives. I mean, I think that the broader problem in an area like this is to try and work out ways of managing road safety when you don't have many roads. I know that sounds a bit silly, but we live in a rural area that has become more and more populated over time, and the road network is that of a rural area. And I think that one of the things I'm working on is how do we fundamentally improve road safety? The answer, in the case of the concrete batching plant and that road, is we have to find alternative routes. I don't really think widening the roads necessarily work. We have to find alternative routes and build new ways of getting particularly HGV traffic off what you might consider to be sort of ordinary passenger type traffic. And I think that that's really what I'm working on in the months and years to come.
Andrew has moved it on to party politics. He sent in a message. He said, I've been a lifelong Conservative, but I'm growing worrisome over the big state attitude of the current incumbents of the party and also the anti-libertarian legislation that is being brought in. Bim, how can the party move so far away from its roots, he asks.
This is a very, very good question. And I think that if I was not in Parliament, I would have been asking exactly the same question myself. I think that COVID has meant that just extraordinary things have been done by the government that are completely against the Prime Minister and the party's instincts. We need to, as quickly as possible, move back to personal responsibility, a smaller, more effective government. And I say smaller, but critically more effective government with as low tax as possible. And making sure that we enable the ordinary people to run their own lives, because ordinary people make the best decisions over their own lives. We have to go much, much as fast as we can back to that as we conceivably can. But when you have a public crisis, public health crisis, there's just a level to which in the moment you have to respond in certain ways and you have to use the levers of the state. But I think the key and what will be judged on is how we can now move back to a more effective system after that.
One of the examples that I would actually like to ask you a bit further on, Bim, talking of personal responsibility, is the introduction of the sugar tax. Do you not think that that goes a little bit counter, again, talking of Boris Johnson, kind of historically there was almost a critique of the nanny state under Labour, Blair, Gordon Brown. Do you not think that that is almost an example of a nanny state situation trying to get people through taxation rather than education?
I basically think that the sustainable way of reducing the amount of sugar and salt in food is to put a lot of pressure on the manufacturers of sugar and salt, of the manufacturers of that food, to reduce those. Now, if they refuse to do so, then I think that you have an issue where you may choose to use a fiscal measure like taxes to do it. I don't think that's what you should reach for. I think we've got to talk to them and try and reduce it. Why am I confident we can achieve it that way rather than through punitive measures of tax? Because we never used to have this level of sugar and salt in our food. It is new. You go back even 40 years and we just didn't do this. And I don't think that we're all, you know, we enjoyed food then. So I do think that we need to see a culture change in that industry. And hopefully we can nudge them towards doing the right thing and reducing that content. That's really the way of doing this. Taxes in and of itself isn't really going to do it.
Yes, I mean, the kind of financial experts have said that there's an inelastic demand anyway for sugar-based products, so that would run counter to it. But on the point of anti-libertarianism, do you think that is almost a mistake then from the government not allowing people to make their own decisions?
But you see, the problem is, right, and look, I've never knew until COVID how much of a libertarian I was, right? The problem is if the food that you can buy with the money you have, all of it has very high sugar and salt content, then I'm afraid you don't have a choice. What is your choice in that instance? You don't. So that's why we need to reduce the percentage of sugar and salt in food more generally. That is the only way you actually are giving people more of a choice. Of course, if you're buying a chocolate bar, it's going to have a high sugar percentage, right? That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about day-to-day food, meats, vegetables, etc., particularly meat. So that is where we need to focus.
Let's turn the focus to the football, though. And off air, we discussed our disappointment with the England losing the final of Euro 2020. But Ian has said that he messaged in June about taking the knee at football matches. Bim, do you believe that the action of fans at the final and the fallout since proves that taking the knee is the right thing to do?
I think that being against racism is the right thing. I don't believe in loyalty tests. So I don't believe that in order to show you're not racist, you have to take the knee. At the same time, I think that if someone chooses to take the knee to show they're against racism, that's completely fine. You know, I think that we should allow people to make their own choices. However, the important thing isn't like taking the knee or not taking the knee. The important thing is, what do you do? And what do you do in your own life? What do you do in your job when you do hiring? What do you do? You know, so I think that too much of modern politics is performative and showing you're against things rather than actually people's actions. And I think we should have much more of a focus on people's actions in relation to the footballers in particular. Now, look, that's the way the team chose to do it. And we should respect that. And I think that that's a sensible thing to do.
Do you think that then people misunderstood when Priti Patel said a similar message to you there, that almost it is less about performative politics and actually doing things in action? Do you think that her message, and maybe some of the other government ministers, was misconstrued?
It may have been, but look, what Priti was doing was she was trying to avoid getting into a row about, you know, if you're a Home Secretary or any politician, frankly, do you really need to be having rows about what a football team should or shouldn't be doing? I think it was really an attempt to get out of that. Now, she may not have succeeded, probably didn't. So, you know, it was an attempt that didn't necessarily go as well as it should have done. But the broader point is that we should not get to the place where we impose sort of loyalty tests on anybody in any position, however senior in politics or whatever, that you have to believe in performing X, or you therefore are not in the place of being against racism. I just think that's a very, very weird, reductive place to be. So by all means, let's focus on if people want to take the knee, that's fine, but let's focus on the actions and what the substance is more than anything else. I have to say, when it comes to football, all the football authorities saying, oh yes, we love taking the knee, etc. How many black managers are there in the Premier, in the Football League? How many black executives do you find in the FA? The answer to both of those questions, not many. So what I'd like to see is the football authorities really focusing on what they actually do, rather than, you know, saying, oh yes, taking the knee is wonderful. Yeah, it may be wonderful, but what are they actually doing in their own game to actually make a difference on these issues?
People would also question having the World Cup at Qatar 2022, where I think 7,000 workers have died, and there's a lot of restrictive measures there as well, Bim. But let's move on to George's question. He's asked, with Freedom Day upon us, what's the biggest positive change that you're looking forward to?
What is the biggest positive change? I think that not having social distancing in pubs and restaurants and things will just enable these guys to just run a proper business. By all means, there are people that, for their own reasons, will choose not to go. And that's completely fine. It's up to them. That's what a free society is about. But most people will want to go. And I know enough local business owners in the constituency who have really struggled over the last year or so. So them being able to run a decent business, I think, is so important.
Andrea has asked, did you see the Big Tub going on tour around Hertfordshire, highlighting water waste? What are you doing to reduce your water waste, Bim?
Did I see it? The answer is no. And did it go around Harpenden, or was it generally around the county?
I think it went to Hitchin. There was pictures of it there.
Right, that's really, really interesting. So I'm holding an event next week on the banks of the River Lee with Affinity Water to promote their sort of, I think it's called the Save Our Streams campaign, and to give local community representatives the chance to discuss challenges and opportunities for river conservation, which I think is really important. We've got the Environment Agency and councillors and various other people. And in particular, you know, there are 200 chalk streams in the world. Almost every single one is in England, and they provide vital habitats and key for biodiversity, which is really, really important. You know, too much of the discussion around the environment is all about CO2 emissions, which is very important, of course, but biodiversity is really, really important as well. So the River Ver, Purwell, Mimram, these are major chalk streams that all flow through the constituency, and they feed into the Lee, the Hiss and the Lee rivers. So it's going to be a big event. So yeah, excited. Tristan. And in terms of water use, you know, Hertfordshire residents use, I think, significantly above the national average. I think Hertfordshire uses something like 160, 165 litres per year per resident. And the UK average is about 110 litres. So that's quite a lot. I can't work out the percentage. So we're looking at coming up to, you know, sort of 40% more than your national average. I think that's really quite important. And we need to reduce this water usage. So there are lots of things you can do in relation to that, whether it be making sure there aren't leaks, dealing with the pipes, but also just in terms of people's actual behaviour and what they do, showers rather than lots of long baths, etc.
Could you also factor in that maybe in the context of how green Hertfordshire is, that people might be having to use more water, especially with this very hot summer, to keep their vegetables and things healthy?
Yes, but we've also had a pretty wet year so far as well. So, you know, the key thing is that when we use water like we use any other resource, we should use it sensibly and proportionately. And if you bear that in mind, then I think we'll all be in better stead.
Tristan has asked, Bim, if you were Prime Minister for one day — I'm not sure if Tristan can read the future and that you are going to be Prime Minister, Bim Afolami — but what would be one law that you would introduce immediately?
Reinstate the role of First Consul. No, joking. What would it be? I'd probably say something like, I'm a big fan of football ownership, fan ownership of football clubs. Not the whole club, but a percentage. Because I think if fans owned, by law, the fans could have a certain percentage of football clubs, say, call it 25%. It would just keep the clubs more honest. It would reduce the number of sort of, you know, anti-fan but probably quite good business decisions that are made. And I just think something like that would give fans more of a stake in their club. It would do all sorts of great things. and wouldn't hurt the owners too much. They'll still be very rich and still have lots of money to buy expensive players. But I think it would just redress the balance a little bit. And that's the sort of thing we could do.
The final question to you, Bim. Hopefully it's a nice one to end on. Susan has asked, you seem so busy and proactive. When do you have time to see your family and spend time with them?
Well, the answer is I don't really see them as much as I used to. But, you know, I think at risk of impending divorce on my wife hearing this, I think you've got to know in life, you've got to know your own nature. And if you are by nature a busy person who does lots of things, you've got to some degree lean into that and know that's what you're like. If I was at home all the time, you know, at home at 6 p.m., seeing my family every day, I'd probably be driven mad and would drive them mad. So knowing my own personality, being quite a busy person suits me fine. I do think, in a slightly more serious way, I do think that it is difficult for members of your family when you're married to somebody like that, because, or if it's your father or whatever, because other dads are around, you know, to do various things and you're not. But at the same time, when I was in the City of London, I frankly worked just as long, well, not just as long, but I worked pretty long hours in a much less hospitable, much less public spirited sort of way. So my view is, you know, it's not so bad. And the great thing about politics is that even when you're busy at weekends, some of the stuff you can do, you can bring your kids along to. For example, I went to a barbecue for a local charity in Harpenden called Harpenden Spotlight on Africa, which we talked about before last weekend, and all my family came. Now, may they have wanted to do something else that day if it wasn't for me? Maybe, but it was a good time. They enjoyed themselves. It was worthwhile. So I think you can slightly make sure they're part of things as well.
I mean, do you set a day or a time that is just BIM family time, or does your schedule not allow that?
No, I do, but more on an ad hoc basis. I don't sort of have a slight, you know, I try not to work too many weekends, but then there's work and work, right? So you've got, you know, I'll often be reading papers. I'll be speaking to my colleagues on the phone. I'll be writing an article. I'll be doing, those are things that I just do on weekends, or you do round and about. Though I'm at home, I'm still doing stuff. So that's often when sort of the other type of work you'll do things, but I try not to sort of do sort of lots of speeches on Sunday mornings and this sort of thing.
Well, Bim, as always, it has been great get answers to the community questions, and great to speak to you.
Thank you.